This is the BC Resource Group's Path to Partner podcast, where we get exclusive insights from the leading figures in legal. And now, here's your host, Colin Moses.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of the Path to Partner podcast, where we take a look at the lives and careers of the legal industry's leaders and see what advice they have for other lawyers looking to advance their careers. Today, we have the pleasure of having Keelan Cavanaugh with us. Keelan is the managing partner of Greenspoon Marder. In addition to her vast legal experience, she has also been continuously recognized by Super Lawyers magazine as one of the New York Metro's super lawyers. So, Keelan, thank you very much for joining us today.
Ed, it's a pleasure to be here. I just want to make one small correction. I'm the managing partner of the New York office of Greenspoon Marder.
Oh, okay.
So you've elevated me a bit. I only want to take credit where credit is due.
Yeah, fair enough.
So, you know, I want to give you a little bit of background about who I am and where I come from.
That was about to be my first question. You've just
there you go.
Jumped in there.
So, you know, just so people can understand where, you know, my point of view is coming from, a very brief biography. I was born and raised in Manhattan. I was born in 1964 and grew up on 30th Street and 2nd Avenue in a building that, of course, has been torn down and a luxury condo now sits there.
Right, of course.
As one might expect. And I went to New York City public schools for my entire primary school education. I was lucky enough to get into Stuyvesant High School, which is a specialized high school here in New York City, with a math and science emphasis. I'm neither a math person nor a science person, but I managed to sneak in on the exam. And then I went to Fordham University, where I studied philosophy.
Oh, wow.
And so I don't know why I kind of fell into it. And I had no particular view as to what I was going to do at the time. I was tending bar and waiting tables in Manhattan. And I had also gotten myself a job as a wholesale bakery manager at an Italian bakery in the East Village. And during, you know, high school and college, I was associating with some artistic types, and I thought I was going to write poetry. And my father, who himself was a writer, intervened on that aspiration and suggested that I might want to earn a living. We, you know, we were not a wealthy family, and he pointed out to me that writing poetry on the East Side and, you know, packing cannolis for bakeries was probably not going to make my fortune. So he suggested very pointedly that I get what he called a trade. And in his view, he was a writer and scholar, a trade was going to law school. And he was a very forceful person, and I decided that I better take his advice. So off I went to law school. And that is sort of how I backed my way into becoming a lawyer. So that's sort of a brief background on how I got to be sitting at Fordham Law School from 1985 to 1988.
Oh, wow. So you were all about the writing and the arts, so to speak. And your dad was just like, no, listen, you need to make money. This is fun and it's cool, but we need you to find a trade. And that's how you pretty much ended up as a lawyer.
That is correct. My father had, of course, I don't want to say struggled, but had certainly, you know, realized how financially daunting trying to write for a living was. And he was fortunate enough to marry my mother, who was, you know, I suppose, a feminist well before her time. She graduated from the University of Pennsylvania in the 40s. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah, and with a master's, and came to New York wanting to get into the new medium of television. It was brand new at the time. And she managed to get herself a job in 1949 at the new National Broadcasting Corporation, NBC, which is one of our networks, as you know. And she was hired as a secretary, and she was so awful at it that they kicked her into production. So she became, in the early 1950s, a producer at NBC. And so when she met my father, she was producing, of course, a St. Patrick's Day special. And she was told to go out and get Brendan Behan, who was a playwright, and he refused her interview. So my father had just published The History of the Abbey Theatre, which is a theatre in Dublin. So he was the second choice for the interview, and he refused to interview as well, but he asked her to, he asked her to lunch. And the rest is history. So that's a long way around. My father married my mother, who worked her whole life in television and was able to help him in his career. So he was a stay-at-home dad, which, you know, was very unusual for the 60s, of course.
Of course. I mean, it's still relatively unusual now, so...
Yeah, yeah. So I know you'll have questions about being a woman in the law, but that gave me a completely different view of women in business growing up in that kind of family.
Yeah, because you pretty much came from a feminist and a feminist family and having your mum be like the head of the household. So I guess how did that shape the way you viewed your career, and how did that shape the way you, I guess, you viewed the way you wanted your career to go?
Well, I suppose throughout my life, I mean, I'm 53 now, I'm actually getting old, but... Throughout my life, women have approached me who want to go into the law or other areas of business. And it's very difficult for me, to, of course, to give them advice, because growing up the way I did in the city with a mother who worked and a father who wrote at home, it was not part of our conversation as to whether women could go out into the workplace and lead. It was just assumed.
Right.
So we never talked about women's issues because at home there weren't any women's issues.
Right, right.
It was just the way it was. So until I actually got to college, Fordham, which was more of a traditional type of school than the schools I had attended in New York City public schools, I didn't even understand that there were these external challenges. So it was actually a surprise to me when I got to Fordham that there was a view that there were differences between men and women. So my early life, certainly through the age of 16, was that there is no difference.
Right.
And then I got to university and realized, oh, yes, there are these people that carry these, what I considered very unusual views of the world, that women and men are different and people of different backgrounds are different. I had grown up in this blissful, you know, era in the 60s and 70s in New York City public schools where we don't have these challenges, did not have those challenges that unfortunately people are facing today.
Right. Now, speaking of the New York City public schools, so I actually read an article yesterday about the desegregation of the New York City public schools, and in particular, the Bronx High School of Science, Stuyvesant, and I think there was one more, Brooklyn Tech, I think it was.
Yeah, so it's the three top specialized schools, or what were the top, there are a couple of others now. And when I got in 1977, I want to say, into Stuyvesant, the same exam or a similar exam that is given to students now was given then. But the city had a different feel. We did not have the, I want to say, ruling class, certainly in Manhattan and now in Brooklyn,
right,
that New York has now. We were kind of all thrown in it together. And the Upper East Side wealthy types would never have tried to get their issue into a New York City public school, be it Stuyvesant or anything else. They were all going to the private schools. So we never ran across each other. There was no cross-pollination between public school students, even in the specialized high schools, and the hyper-wealthy of that era. What is happening now is you have a couple of things going on. You have these ultra-wealthy Manhattanites are putting their students, their children, into these training programs to pass these exams.
Right.
So you have this skewed population in these specialized schools. And then the question is, well, what do we do? What do we do with the kids that are actually really public school students that don't have parents that can afford to spend tens of thousands of dollars preparing them for these exams? It's not fair. So you have to address that. And I think de Blasio and company are trying to. I'm not sure that their proposal is what makes the most sense, but at least they're trying to address this inequity, which we didn't have when I took the exam and got in. I would never get in now.
Right. Yeah.
There was no chance I would get into Stuyvesant High School now. Not a prayer.
Wow.
But, you know, when I took the exam, we all kind of took the exam. Nobody really cared. If you didn't get in, you went to your local school. No big deal. But as is everything, and as, of course, is in the law, getting into law school now, it's become hyper-competitive. And people that can spend the money prepping for exams, prepping for the LSAT, for example, are going to have an advantage. And that gives people with more money, I think, a really unfair advantage. What do we do about it? I don't have those answers, but it's not a happy place where we are right now.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, because like in the article that I read, it pretty much said exactly what you said. It's that certain people can spend 2 years essentially of weekends and after school programs prepping their kids to take these tests for both at high school level and for the college entrance test, the SATs and that type of thing. And so it's not really based on how naturally smart someone is. It's based on who has had the best preparation because of the resources behind them.
That's right.
So, and I think
we're not going to solve that problem today, Colin.
You never know.
Yeah. You never know. That's right. Miracles happen.
Exactly. So I think what they were suggesting was having a lottery for everyone that scores 85% or above on the test, and that way making it a little bit more fair. So,
yeah, you know, something has to be done. And yeah. I think you have to start somewhere. That might not be the best solution. I don't have the best solution, but a lottery certainly takes out of the equation the people that have the time and the money to what I think is gaming the system.
Right.
So my husband has been in the New York City public school system for longer than I've been in the law, so over 30 years.
Oh,
and
wow.
He works in the South Bronx and always has for his entire career. And it's very frustrating for him, where he knows he has these intelligent students that, if the playing field were more even, would in fact be going to the Bronx Sciences and Brooklyn Techs and Stuyvesants.
Right.
But aren't. So, you know, it's something that needs to be addressed. And I'm glad to see that de Blasio is at least thinking about it.
Yeah. Now, do you feel like what the problem there is like a microcosm of just the problems we have in society as a whole, in that, you know, it's the people that, you know, have the resources, have the money, that just not only get ahead in as far as schools go, but just in life. Like, that's what, if you have parents that have connections, those connections are going to get you somewhere. And having resources kind of feeds into having connections.
Yeah, I suppose one would say it has always been thus, yes?
Yeah.
And they tried to solve it in Russia, and they tried to solve it in Cuba, and they wrote Utopia about it,
right,
and
right.
we still haven't figured it out. I think that during my lifetime, certainly, things have swung to what I consider the darker side. I think there is more of a spread between the haves and have-nots since I grew up in the 70s, and I assume that everything's cyclical and it'll swing back again. I see with hope the teachers in Arizona and other places striking.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that was effective. I read this morning that I think New York Magazine or the New Yorker Magazine has unionized. So you're seeing things that remind me of the turn of the last century, where labor is just pissed off.
Yeah.
and is starting to raise up again. Because they're facing the same issues.
I mean,
we have no health care
coverage.
That's
kind of what's led to the political climate that we're in as well, hasn't it? So
Yeah, I know. It's, you know, that Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. That's exactly where we're living right now.
Yeah.
So anyway, we're getting so far afield.
Yeah, we are.
I can talk about this forever.
Yeah, we're just way off topic. All right, so back to law and legal.
Right.
So what were your early years in legal like?
Okay, so I went to law school from 1985 to 1988, and I went to Fordham, which was at that time, you know, a well-regarded second-tier law school. It's reconstructed itself and is moving up the ranks, but it was an okay kind of local school, certainly a respectable place to go, you know, for somebody who knew they were going to be practicing in New York.
Right.
And I really enjoyed it, which I was very surprised that I would, because, of course, I was, you know, until I entered law school, going to be writing poetry and tending bar for the rest of my life. It was the first time that I had been involved in what I really want to call a vocational sort of education. So I went from studying philosophy to learning what's a contract, how does it work, how do you own real estate. So it was very much sort of a vocational exercise as opposed to an intellectual exercise, which I suppose would infuriate a lot of lawyers. Right. But to me, it was a big change from sort of thinking about very ephemeral ideas to, all right, how do we take these rules and apply them practically? And it had also piqued my interest because in 1979, we lived on 30th Street and 2nd Avenue. My parents were threatened by a developer with eviction. So we were thrown immediately into the legal system. I had had really no exposure to the legal system before that. So, trying to evict us down at landlord-tenant court and so on. So when I got into law school, we were fighting that throughout the 80s. And when I got into law school, I became very interested in real estate and landlord-tenant work because we were still trying to protect our apartment on 30th Street and 2nd Avenue. So I found on the bulletin board a little notice of a lawyer who was looking for a law student to help him. And coincidentally, his specialty happened to be landlord-tenant law. So it was in my first year of law school, I started working for this solo practitioner. He was a very strange guy. And just to take a little sidebar as to women in the law, when he interviewed me, this would have been in 1985 or six, he sat me down and he looked at me and he very dryly said, you know, I don't like to hire women. They tend to cry. So I said, I'm not a big crier. And he said, all right, I'll give you a chance. So well, I went
different
to
times.
Those different times. But I'd done no big deal. You just shrug it off and keep going.
Right.
So, and actually he's one of my dearest friends 30 years later, believe it or not. So I went to work for him and really loved it. I loved being in court. I loved saving people's apartments and interviewing clients. It was just so much fun. And I worked for him for the first and second years. And then I was fortunate enough to get a summer associate position. So for those of you who are not in law school and who are thinking about it, between your second and third years of law school, you try and get a job, and it's called a summer associate position. And you try and get a job with a firm that you think you would be interested in working for after graduation, because some of these programs, if they like you, they'll offer you a job. So I was fortunate enough to get a summer associate position with an old line New York City law firm. And I worked there for the summer. And it was a completely different experience than with this rough and tumble solo practitioner, landlord tenant guy. This firm was very white tower, commercial work, had been in business since the 1800s.
Oh, wow.
Somebody's father had been New York City corporate counsel in the 30s and 40s. They'd been around forever.
Yeah.
And they were very well respected. And they had a great book of business. But they were all male.
Of course.
All white. And were just getting used to women coming into the law. So it was challenging and frightening and exciting. And you kind of had to, I was so naive, I didn't know what I was doing. But I started to realize, as I had back in college, that people carry a lot of prejudice and baggage, and you have to learn, and I'm sure it's even now is the case, you have to learn how to navigate around that or through it, depending on what your approach is.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
I'll give you a perfect example. This firm that I went to, one of the partners was the head of an exclusive all-male club in New York. And we don't really have those anymore because there was a big lawsuit in the late 80s because these men were doing business in these clubs. And of course, women couldn't go in because it was all male. So one of our partners was a president of this all male club, and we used to have our Christmas parties there. So the women who were at the firm would show up for the Christmas party, and there would be this big sign in the lobby, "Welcome, Mr. Member." Women, and there was an arrow. So we used to have to take a separate elevator. You weren't allowed to wander the halls.
They weren't even subtle about it. They're just like, you guys go over there.
Back there somewhere. So in my first or second year, I was fortunate enough to be hired after my summer associateship position. I organized a boycott of the Christmas party. And they didn't fire me.
Wow.
So, yeah. So it was really, it was, you know, I don't know what I was thinking. My 53-year-old self cringes when I think about it.
It's that feminism up, that feminist upbringing. That's what it is.
I didn't know. Yeah. I thought it was so offensive.
That's awesome, though. I mean, you might cringe, but I think that's amazing that you did that. And, you know, without even like realizing the impact you were having at the time, it's just like, oh, this isn't right. Let's do something about this.
Well, I had a certain freedom. My parents killed themselves to make sure that when I graduated from law school, I didn't owe a dime. Okay. Mm. So there would have been consequences in that I would have been kicked out of my first job. But these people that are graduating from law school now owing hundreds of thousands of dollars, you can't take those risks.
Right.
Because you don't have that freedom. So I have to temper my, I don't know, my revolutionary views of the time with a warning that I had a freedom that maybe a lot of kids coming out of law school wouldn't have.
Of course.
So if I was staring down the gun of, you know, $250,000 in loans at the time, I might have thought twice. But I had that freedom, and I am in debt forever to my parents for making the sacrifices that they had to make to get me through no money owing.
Definitely. But do you really think you would have considered it? Had you?
I don't know. Yeah. I was 23. Probably,
probably not.
Not,
yeah.
Never having been a very sensible person around that time, probably not.
Right.
But I have to say that the partner who was president of this club had the good humor to take it in his stride and say, okay, I get it. I understand. We'll have it someplace else. And then a few years later, the big case whose name escapes me, I don't know what club it was, but they were sued. And then the law was changed and you could not do business in a one gender club. So that was the end of that. But I had the good fortune to also have partners who liked me and would put up with my behavior. So, you know, not everybody has that luck.
Wow. That's awesome. Like you would like.
Oh, I have hundreds of these
blazing trails from the get go.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
And you know, I also really I loved what I was doing.
Yeah.
So I wasn't beaten down by rotten work or nasty partners or anything like that. I was just really having a lot of fun.
It sounds like it.
Which would be my advice. Yeah, it would be my advice to everybody. Look, I mean, whatever it is that you're doing, if you're not enjoying yourself and you have the financial freedom to make a change. Make a change, you know.
Definitely.
I'm 53. I can't believe it, but life is really too short to be miserable in what you're doing.
Yeah, it doesn't seem short until you start getting older. And then, oh wow.
You betcha, Colin.
I was just 20 the other day. What happened?
It really feels that way. So don't waste time.
All right. Now, well, speaking of time, how do you deal with work-life balance? And like, do you have time for other interests outside of work? And if so, how do you make time for them?
Well, you know, that answer changes depending on where you are in your career.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're young and learning and at the mercy of your bosses, obviously that's more difficult. And I have to say that it's not the worst thing, and it's something that I did early on in my career. It's not the worst thing to put off outside interests like parasailing or whatever rocks your boat to really, you know, knuckle down and learn what you're supposed to be doing for a living. And if you have to put 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years really into getting it right, do it. And that time spent learning what it is that you want to do and learning it well, that will free you up later in your life when you might need a little more time for work-life balance. I don't think anybody in their early 20s needs a tremendous amount of work-life balance. Learn your craft. And then, you know, in your late 20s, you're good. You're an expert in your field and people want you. And if you're in demand, you have more control.
Yeah, definitely.
So my advice, humble as it may be, and what worked for me is I spent a lot of time sleeping under conference room tables when I was a young associate. And I spent a lot of time sitting at the feet of people who really knew how to try cases, mm-hmm. how to structure depositions. I'm a litigator, by the way.
Right.
How to handle witnesses, all of that. And because I spent the time, it wasn't hard for me later. I get it. I know how it works. I'm learning all the time, by the way. You never have complete control of your subject.
Right.
But I think that if you really buckle down when you're young and learning and become an expert, that will help you be freer later.
Later on.
And that's what's worked for me.
Okay.
So, you know, I do pay a lot of attention to how much time am I spending at work? How much time am I spending at home? I make sure that, you know, I care for, my husband would die laughing at this, I care for my relationships. I pay attention. He would say this is all entirely false, but it's what I strive right, for right. anyway. Pay attention to the people around you
yeah.
and schedule things. Don't waste time. And again, this is all much easier if you really enjoy what you're doing. Look, there have been times over the last 30-something years where I've said to myself, what am I doing? This is entirely the wrong thing. I hate this. But it's actually the day that I'm hating. It's not my career choice. I have really been very fortunate to love what I have been doing the past 30 years.
Yeah.
So.
That's awesome. Your advice for young lawyers is work-life balance, no such thing in your early 20s. You work and work and work. And then by the late 20s, you'll be able to have a little more freedom.
Become an expert in your field.
Right.
And once you're an expert in your field, you can write your own ticket. And you won't have to spend so much time on a particular task because it becomes natural to you.
It becomes natural. And I guess the more experience you get, you can start to delegate things and show other people how to do it.
You can't delegate unless you're an expert yourself.
Right, right.
Because you can't manage. If you don't know what you're managing, you can't manage. So you're always going to be a subordinate.
Yeah.
Right? And the goal from the beginning is you want to be a manager of your business. So the only way to do that is either you come with a complete book of business because you've, you know, stepped out with a silver spoon in your mouth, going back to those with advantages and those without advantages, right?
Right.
So if you're in the private practice of law, how do you succeed? You have to have a book of business. You have to have clients. You have to produce money. Mm-hmm. It's a business like any other. So you do that either because you've been handed it on a silver platter, or you develop your network and your connections, and you spend the first 5 or 6 years becoming an expert in your field. So you actually have a product to sell to people, and you do a tremendous amount of networking throughout college and law school and your first few years in the business.
So is that how you developed, or I shouldn't say you, but is that how you would advise your associates to develop their business, is just to network and meet as many people as possible and build those connections? Like, I don't know, like, if there's a way specifically that you tell your associates that are looking or come to you for advice on, oh, how do I build business? How do I make myself more valuable and get clients and that type of thing? Like, do you have a certain piece of advice that you give to them or that you would give to them?
Well, you know, like anything else, it is specific to the individual.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the person's background? Who do they know? Are they a wonderful writer who can write practice articles, for example? Are they a terrific public speaker who can get in front of industry audiences and do presentations on topics that would interest that particular industry?
Yeah.
So can you write something and get out in front of the market that way? Can you go out and speak? Are they wonderful raconteurs where you have them out at cocktail parties and everybody loves them? You know, what's that individual strength? But you have to get out and about. But first, you have to have something to sell.
Mm-hmm.
So either you have an expertise yourself, or you have these connections that you can bring into the firm and sell on to the lawyers who can actually do the work. So you can be what we call in the business, right, a rainmaker, somebody who makes the business, somebody who services the business, which is your competency, or you have, you know, the perfect meld of both, somebody who can bring the business in and do the business, which is where, you know, you make the most money.
Right.
But you have to start those connections early on, because you never know where the guy who sits next to you in algebra is going to end up.
Definitely.
He could end up being CFO of some big company or general counsel of some big company. And he's the one who's going to call his college buddy. Happens all the time. So business, except for the very large firms which have institutional clients that don't care if you bring in business or don't bring in business, they just want you servicing the clients that have been there since the turn of the, you know, the 1890s, right? The Standard Oil folks, you need to bring in that business, because certainly if you talk to any headhunter now, where it's called a lateral move, for those of you who aren't familiar with this, you're at one law firm and you want to move laterally to another law firm. If you're looking for certainly a partnership position or even a senior associate position, a headhunter is going to say to you, okay, what are your portables?
Right.
And by that, they mean how much business are you porting laterally from one firm to another? And that's what they're going to be asking you.
Right.
And if the answer is zero, your options become very limited, unfortunately.
So, like you see, exactly. And I have that conversation with people all the time about,
it's very hard.
It is.
You know, a lot of it is luck, but a lot of it is also and I wish I had somebody to tell me this way back when. I didn't. A lot of it is starting even in high school.
Yeah.
And I don't like sort of turning friendships into a marketing opportunity. It's sort of a icky kind of way of looking at life.
Yeah.
But, you know, unfortunately, that's the way the world works right now. And business is done, for the most part, on personal contacts. So, you know, people have to start thinking about that very early on. And, of course, people who are going to, you know, expensive private schools have a leg up there.
Yeah, definitely.
So, you know, for those of us who didn't, you kind of luck into your contacts. But stay out there, make a lot of friends, keep talking, and make sure that you spend a lot of time, you know, focusing on developing business.
Awesome. Now, we've kind of touched on this already. Specific challenges as a woman in the legal field for you, what were they?
Well, I hope that these are all things of the past. I certainly haven't come across them recently, but I probably wouldn't. You know, other than the very funny story about my first employer not wanting to hire a female litigator because they tend to cry, I had a number of awkward, how do I put this? I put it bluntly. You know, sexual harassment scenarios when I was a young associate. There were a couple of partners that made inappropriate advances, and I shut them down. Now, I never had any repercussions from them. And again, going back to my boycotting the all-male club, I didn't have anything hanging over my head that would really have caused me fear of retribution. Right. So, again, I have to say that I was very fortunate to be in that position where I was sort of damn the torpedoes. If they come after me, they come after me.
Yeah.
But I remember those things to this day. And I remember when they happened at the time, telling my then boyfriend, now husband, that they had happened. And it was an awful thing. And I'm sure women are still running up against those things. My advice to women would be, don't feel threatened. Report them immediately. Don't give the guy a second chance. You know, just go in and get it reported. Because certainly, you know, given this new Me Too movement, which I hope continues and grows and gives women who are the victim of these kinds of things a voice, don't give them a second chance. And I was, again, lucky enough to be sort of this, I don't know, person without a real long view. So I didn't give them a second chance. And I actually know both guys to this day, and we're friendly.
Okay.
So, you know, we talk through it, and, you know, how people think that they can act that way is really quite extraordinary. But, you know, I can't analyze it. I don't know.
Well, there was more of a sense of entitlement back then, wasn't there, among...
It was men in power. Nobody was telling them that they couldn't do anything that they wanted to do. You would be called into these conference rooms with 25 guys looking at you. You know, you were sitting down at the end of the table. and you would get a job review or something, right. You know, along those lines. It's very intimidating. Wow. But I hope things are changing. But I know that these things, obviously, we know they're happening right now. And for women in the law, don't put up with it. That's all I can tell you.
Yeah. Well, I imagine that when the whole Me Too movement thing happened and, like, you know, the Weinstein allegations came out, that, like, for me, obviously, as a guy, I didn't even, it's never crossed my mind that these type of things happen. Because unless you're someone that does it or has seen it or just something that doesn't really cross your mind. But I'm guessing for you, it was just like, oh, this is about time. This has come to the forefront. This is not unexpected. This has happened. I've seen it happen. I've been a part of it. So did you expect it to, I guess, take on what it's taken on?
Well, this is my, I suppose, a lack of sensitivity that I have to these issues. And I recognize that as a big failing for me. These difficulties that I ran up against would have been, I don't know, early 1990s, mid 1990s. And I then, I suppose, forgot about it in a way until this wave started up again. Mm-hmm. So I had a lot of difficulties, you know, with obstreperous, nasty guys opposite me. I remember some guy told me in a hallway once, he said, "Honey, grow up, you're a big girl now," over some ruling or something. You know, the way guys would talk to you when you were a young female lawyer 25 years ago. Shocking. Yeah. I hope that doesn't happen now. Somebody would have to let me know if it still does. I hope that doesn't happen now. But getting back to your point, I guess I kind of forgot about it. And I haven't had any women come to me when I was managing partner of my prior firm or at my current firm where they've come to me and said, a guy's been inappropriate. Now, I hope that's because it wasn't happening. I don't know what the prevalence of that behavior is now in the law. I hope that we're more sensitive to it than perhaps the showbiz industry is, because we're, of course, the people who need to be enforcing these rules, right?
Exactly.
So if it's out there in the law, you know, I just hope women who are victims of it are aggressively pushed back, because certainly I would hope that they would be supported by their HR departments and vigorously defended.
Yeah. Well, I mean, now it's that it's out in the open, you've got to think that we're moving in the right direction and things will only get better from here, hopefully at least.
I certainly hope so. Yeah. It's way overdue.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah.
All right. So changing topics, what were some of your early leadership lessons, whether that's like when you first entered as an associate or as you became managing partner and you started to take on more leadership roles?
So let me start from when I was somebody who was being led as opposed to leading others. When I started my career at this law firm that I really loved, I spent 13 years there and became a partner for the first time in this firm. I observed good leadership and really bad leadership. And the good leadership that I was fortunate enough to be a part of were the litigators, all male, of course, at that point. I've unfortunately never had the experience of having a woman manager. So all of my experience is being mentored by men. But the positive experience that I had at my prior firm were these old-time litigators, and I mean, they 60s and 70s, back when I started 30 years ago, so they'd be, you know, over 100 now if they were still alive, just so interested in teaching a young lawyer what they knew and all of the mistakes that they made and all of the tricks that they learned, how to talk to a certain type of jury. What are you looking for when you're deposing a witness or defending a motion? You know, all of these intricate hints of how to be a great lawyer. And these people that I remember to this day were so interested in my professional development. And also in my personal life, they would be interested in me as a whole person, not just, you know, here's the memo, how good was it, how bad was it? And I've always tried to copy that kind of leadership, sometimes well, sometimes not, I am sure the people who I managed will tell you. But those were the lawyers who helped me really learn how to do my job and taught me how to lead people. Now, the converse were the difficult, petulant, prima donna type of lawyer who we will all meet in our careers if you spend enough time in the law, who are concerned only with their own professional advancement and treat associates like galley slaves. Right. And all they want is product. They don't care how they get it. They're not going to assist you in developing your writing skills or your analysis. They're going to fling memos back at you, ripped up or worse. Right. And they're still out there. And those are the worst type of legal managers that, you know, the people who are going to go into the business who are listening to me will run across. And you have to navigate around them. And you have to learn how to deal with them, because some of them will be in power and some of them can really impact your career.
Yeah, yeah.
But you can learn from it, because not only will you have bosses like that, you're going to run into judges like that.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
You know? Yeah. So it's a learning experience, and you're going to definitely run into adversaries like that.
Wow.
So while it's unpleasant at the time, if you can view it as a learning experience, how can I get around this person? How can I just make this work for me? What can I learn from it and the skills that I take away from it? While unpleasant, it'll be of benefit to you at the end of the day. So to lead, you want to be like the first type, and to not act like the person that is torturing you, don't be like that. That's not an example, but obviously lawyers are learning from other lawyers because generationally those people still exist in the business.
Exactly. And I think a lot of it is I had this type of manager and I learned and it toughened me up. So that's what I'm going to do for my associates or whoever's in front of me in the court or whatever it is, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Don't be like that. That debases the business.
Right.
It debases the business. And look, it's in every business. Doctors say, oh, I had to work 120 hours in a row, so you have to. You know, don't be like that. So learn from it, but don't adapt that behavior. It embarrasses me when I run into people like that. It embarrasses me when I see brats like that on the bench. That's not what the law is. We should be much higher brow than that.
Definitely.
I think
definitely. So have you had any feedback about your leadership or management style, and if so, what has it been?
I haven't.
And everyone's
I'm afraid that's because I'm such a horrible threat. So, and I'm sure that some of the people who have worked for me throughout their lives would die laughing at this, but I like to try and be in the middle of things. So, you know, I'm not kind of waving a wand and saying, you shall do this and you shall do that. When we're prepping for trial or we're prepping for a big series of depositions or we're analyzing material so that we can set a strategy together, we're all sitting together, associates and other partners and paralegals. I like to really get everybody together because I am not the smartest person in the room. And if I am the smartest person in the room, I don't have the right people working with me, because I need to have people smarter than me who have better ideas, who see holes in things that I don't see. So I like to think, for the most part, that it is a collaborative effort among my team. That is not to say that at the end of the day, I will not make decisions that will make people unhappy, that they'll think aren't the right decisions, but somebody's got to make the decision. Yeah. So, you know, at the end of the day, you got to move it forward. And probably people will say that I can be a little intimidating and lacking in patience. And I recognize that. I really, really try. But there are some days when, you know, I'm just not as good a person as I should be.
We all have those days, don't we?
Yeah. But if you talk to people who worked with me, they may say she has them more often than not. I don't know. But from a management standpoint, quite seriously, you have to respect the people that you're working with. And you have to listen to them, take their ideas, work with their ideas, and recognize that your way might not be the best way forward. Right. So, I mean, that's really all I can say about that. I try and treat the people that I work with the way I would want to be treated.
Wow. It's the only way
you can go through life, really, right?
Well, it's not the only way you can go through, but I think that's the way we should go through, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I don't succeed all the time. But in the back of my mind, it's, okay, if I were a fourth-year associate looking at this person dealing with this issue, how would I want to be treated? You try.
Yeah.
That's the best you can do.
Awesome. Going on to like the actual path to partner that you took and how you got to where you are now, is there anything specific that you think really helped you? Is there anything that you would have done differently that maybe would have advanced your career quicker?
Yeah. So I would have spent more time getting business connections, doing all the stuff that we talked about, you know, 10 minutes ago. What happened with me early in my career is an enormous multi-district litigation was brought in by my firm. I was a first-year associate at the time. And it was a case that was being litigated all over the world. There were, I don't know, hundreds of depositions. I don't even know at this point. It was a huge case. And I was completely immersed in it from the beginning of my career until my fourth or fifth year. Mm-hmm. So I did not emerge from that case until I was well into my fifth year. I had spent no time networking, no time writing anything, no time, you know, giving talks. So I was sort of in a bubble until, you know, I was a fairly mid-level to senior level associate with no book of business because we had been working on this institutional client. And so I was starting kind of late in developing business. And that, I think, put a crimp in my ability to, you know, force my candidacy for partner in my prior firm. I did make partner, but I made partner, I think I was in my ninth or 10th year, which was probably around 2 years behind where I wanted to. Because again, I had been closeted with this enormous case, which was a wonderful case. And I learned everything, Hague Convention and like everything you could possibly want to learn in a federal case, I learned. But it put a crimp in my business. So I think that, again, my advice to people who are considering law is you have to really focus on developing business in addition to developing your skills. And if somebody had told me that way back when, that would have been a real benefit for me.
Wow. When it comes to people that you're hiring, what is it that you look for when you're making bets on the people that you invest in?
So I want to preface this with it is, for me, you know, a real crapshoot. Some of my candidates have gone on to wonderful things. One guy who worked for me has been a serial CEO and has just been fantastic.
I'm sure it was all your mentorship that did that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He wouldn't agree with you. And some people have been a complete and utter crash and burn. So I don't think that there is any crystal ball as to what candidates are going to succeed and what candidates are going to fail. I also don't think that hiring somebody from the top law schools are necessarily going to get you a better candidate. Mm-hmm. I think that people who have done very well in any particular law school, who have really, you know, shown an ability to get great grades, maybe write on a journal, maybe had really good internships, I think those are the people that I try and focus on because at least they've shown an interest in what they're doing and an ability to get good grades in courses that they're going to have to apply in some part to the work that they're doing. I also look for people who can write because by the time you get out of law school, I think it's nigh on impossible to learn how to write. If you don't know by that time, forget it. So I look for good writing samples. And I also look for people who don't need to be led around by the nose. There are many, many associates that I have had work with me who just want to get the assignment off their desk. Mm-hmm. So what they'll do with, say, a legal memo is they'll come in and give you a first draft. Or they'll give you an unedited, you know, not proofed piece of paper simply because they want to get it off their desks. I'm looking for people that are going to own their product and that are only going to present the best possible product to me. Look, it can have mistakes in it. If you're a first or second year associate, of course it will. But it has to be something that the person who is producing it is proud of. And those are for young hires, that's what I'm looking for. You know, mid-levels, it's a little bit different. You know, mid-levels, you have to have somebody with really a proven track record in the particular field that you're looking for. Obviously, I understand what that is in litigation. Mm-hmm. It might be something entirely different in real estate or corporate or bankruptcy. But for young lawyers, it's can you write? Did you get good grades in law school? And, you know, are you somebody who is going to do their best to produce the best possible product and not try and shove something off their desk onto mine?
Okay. Now, how do you interview and hire?
Right. So I have absolutely no system, as will not surprise you. I call the resumes in the way that I've said. I don't really give a lot of weight to the law school itself, but to the grades. And, you know, the writing sample, which I would review before I would bring somebody in. And then, you know, I'll bring them in and I'll just talk to them. You know, where do they come from? What interests them? Why did you go to law school? You know, what was your favorite course?
Right.
So who are they?
Yeah.
Is it somebody that I want to spend weeks on end with trying a case? You know, it's somebody, you know, so personality really plays a big part for me, right? For mm-hmm. me. Because I have to spend my life with you when I'm at the office.
Yeah.
You know, can this person read people? Do they have, I hate to say this, it's such a cliche, do they have a sense of humor? Because, you know, if spending hours on end with a humorless person is
torture,
not very pleasant. So, you know, that's the kind of thing I look for. I don't have any canned interview questions. I think they're stupid. You know, where are you in 5 years? I couldn't tell you that. I mean, and if I am telling you that, I'm blowing a lot of hot air.
So, I think sometimes, you know, people ask that question, it's not for a prediction. It's just to see how you handle the question. And
I know, but if the person turns to you and say, that's a really stupid question, so where does that get you? Right?
I don't think that might get you hired.
Because that's what I'd be thinking.
Right.
But instead, the poor person is trying to answer the question because they know that that's coming and they have to answer it. I'd like to say that's a totally stupid question. How is that going to help you evaluate
my case? I actually feel like in your early years, that may be something you would have said because you seem like someone that you just don't care.
I hope not. Again, with the caution, I had the freedom to do that. So I am not bragging that I was so fabulous. I just happened to have the freedom, and not everybody does. I'm just saying now, as a grown-up, I would not ask that question. I think those questions are stupid. Mm-hmm. And I know Google and Facebook and Apple and all of the places that have these canned questions would disagree with me. I don't think it's really going to reveal who the individual is that you're talking to. You know, they will have looked up your questions on the internet. They will have put a little canned answer in, and that's all you're getting.
That's why you got to throw them a curveball with the questions.
Yeah. It's like, hey, you know, why did you study marine biology?
Right.
Tell me about it, you know, and from marine biology to the law, why? And who knows what the answers are?
Yeah.
I don't know. But, and I'm successful 50% of the time. So maybe I should be asking them the canned questions. I don't know.
So what's your industry outlook for like the next 2 to 5 years?
So that's such an interesting question. I saw that on your list. If you had talked to me last year, I probably would have said to whoever is listening to this, under no circumstances consider law school. It's a dying profession. But with the economy going the way it's going. And of course, it's always cyclical. When I graduated from law school, nobody was being hired either. And it's happened at least once or twice since I graduated that, you know, the market has been terrible and our graduates are attending bar somewhere. It happens. But right now, I think it's probably not a bad career decision. You're looking, for example, I'll give you a perfect example. I forget which law firm it is that just goosed up the starting salary of these elite law firms to 190, right? So that salary hadn't moved in a really, really long time. I think it had been at 180. I don't know. Don't quote me on this. It might have been 10 years. A long time. So I think that that might be an indicator of the fact that demand for legal services is on the increase. And it wouldn't surprise me, right? So businesses are booming, hiring is up, the unemployment rate's, you know, 3 point something percent. And when business is booming, demand for legal services necessarily follows. Yeah. So probably not a bad career choice now. As far as for my industry, when business is booming, people get in fights with each other and litigation happens, right? So for the litigation business, it's always a positive. It's also a positive when things go wrong because then people sue each other too because they're trying to get every nickel out of a deal.
It's a win-win for you.
It's win-win. But as a career choice, for people who are planning to work in the law, not just get a law degree and do something else, which isn't a bad choice either, my reading the tea leaves is if you do well, meaning if you're in the top 10 to 15% of your class, I'd say you'd get work that might pay your bills.
Cool. All right. So there's only a couple more questions now. I wanted to ask you if there's been any external factors that have impacted your practice over the last few years, like legislation or the outcome of the election or anything like that, that has had a specific impact on your practice?
Yeah, my particular business is, for good or for bad, not really impacted by either change in legislation or economic indicators. As I just mentioned, it's kind of a win-win. Yeah. We do general commercial big business disputes. And those are going to happen no matter the economic climb. Our particular business, because it tends to be contract related, is not really impacted by regulatory changes. So for my particular line of business, the answer would be, on the whole, no, not really impacted by external factors.
Okay. Cool. Now, I wanted to ask you also about cannabis legislation, and because I know that's like a part of what you guys have done there. So I just wanted to get an impact or get an idea of what you what your role was when it comes to that and what your firm has done and your views on the legalization and that type of thing.
Yeah, so my firm is very interesting in that they were in the vanguard of starting a cannabis-related legal department. And as the legalization trend is sort of washing over the United States, you know, Colorado and Oregon and California and Florida and on, our firm has been part of looking at all of the really unique issues raised by cannabis. Because you're dealing, of course, with a product that is legal, depending on the state that you're in, and completely illegal under federal law. And that throws up a very unique set of legal challenges for the people in the business and, of course, the lawyers who are looking into this. So that is an exciting and developing area. Now, where my particular practice intersects cannabis is in the what happens when you put a product into the market that is now legal and people use and they get hurt by it. So nobody was going to sue their corner dealer when they were injured by the dime bag that they purchased. But when industry gets involved and products get manufactured and sold, there is then a defendant for individuals that use that product. Now, it's a new industry. So this is, I think, at the very, very, I don't know, baby stage of what's going to happen, and I'm telling you what's going to happen, is it's going to look a lot like the tobacco industry. So it's smoked, they drink it, it's in pill form. How does it affect the user? Does it cause illness? All of these things are going to be happening in the near future with users of this product. And I'll give you a very interesting example. There was a lawsuit, which I think is still pending out in Colorado. A guy bought a package of edible cannabis candies, right? So he buys these candies and he goes home, and in his wisdom, he eats the whole bag of them and shoots his wife in the head and murders her in front of her two children. Oh, wow. Lawsuit brought by the survivors against the manufacturer of the edibles because there had been no warning on the package that if you ate the whole package, you might have a psychotic break, which is a side effect that has been reported in the scientific literature of overdosing on a cannabis product. So the question in the lawsuit was, and I think is, I haven't looked at it recently, what were the duties of the manufacturer of this edibles to warn, right? There was no dosage on the package. What is the responsibility of the manufacturer? And this is where I think it's going to get really interesting for my business, which is how do we help these companies that are entering this new business protect themselves? What about warnings on the package? What about dosage? What else can you do to make sure that you don't put your company in the crosshairs of a plaintiff who has eaten a whole package of edibles, right? Now, if you don't put a warning on the package, he's going to say, you didn't tell me I shouldn't do that. It's your fault, not mine, that I shot my wife in the head. Horrible story.
This is
where I think it's going to get super interesting.
Yeah. That's such a crazy story. Like, when you think of the legalization, you never think of side effects that drastic at all. Like, it'd be the last thing that would come to your mind of something that extreme happening.
Exactly. But you see, that's the lawyer's job who are representing these people that are getting into this industry to tell them, hey, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? How do we help you get out in front of these issues so you don't make those mistakes? Right. That's where the lawyer comes in, because these people are entrepreneurs, they're big thinkers. They're not thinking about, oh, hell, you know, I'm going to be sued.
Exactly.
That's their lawyer's job. That's where the counseling part of the law comes in. And it's so much fun because that's where you get involved in strategy and business decisions and protection of the business that you're growing. And my firm really is at the forefront of that.
Wow, that's amazing.
So,
all right.
Yeah, it's
last question. I just want to finish off with any final career advice that you'd give to either college grads or lateral transfers that are looking to maybe work with you one day.
They're kind of two separate answers. For college students who are thinking about a career in the law, ask yourself, why do I want a career in the law? And try and educate yourself about the different ways to work in the law. It's not just law firms. It's government, state and federal level, of course. It's nonprofits, private companies, law enforcement. There are all kinds of areas where lawyers are hired and are deployed, and those career paths are very, very different. So if you really are in college and you're thinking about it, spend some time over a summer visiting various places where lawyers practice. Do a little bit of reading. Don't watch TV because none of those law programs bear any resemblance to any area of practice. So do a little bit of homework, because going to law school is a huge time commitment. I mean, it's 3 years of your life, and now it's upwards of, I don't know, $200,000. Yeah. So don't make that decision lightly. Call around, lawyers are happy to, for the most part, I certainly am, happy to talk to you so that you can go in with your eyes open instead of kind of backing into it because you're a philosophy major with nowhere else to go. You know, educate yourself. Now, for those people who have already gone through law school and are looking for work, the advice is the same but different. So you've already made the commitment, you've spent the money, you've received your law degree and have been admitted to the bar. Step back and think, what is it that I want to do? Do I want to do corporate deals? What kind of corporate deals? Why do I want to do corporate work or real estate or trials or anything like that? I guess it's the same thing. Talk to people, watch trials, you know, ask if you can, you know, sit in on a corporate deal. And then learn the culture of the places that you're targeting for work. Do you want a big law firm? Do you want a medium-sized law firm? Do you want to work in a two-person shop? I mean, these are all things that you need to consider. Yeah. And again, it's a lot of homework. There are so many opportunities presented to a person with good class ranking and a law degree. I mean, I don't want to say the world is your oyster, but you have a tremendous number of opportunities available to you. So don't fall in to a job. Don't say, I'm going to be an associate at a law firm. Educate yourself as to what options are out there and pick what you think is going to give you the most joy.
Awesome. Well, that is all the questions I have for you today, Keelan. So thank you very much. Is there anything interesting that you guys are working on that you can share or anything that you want to let the listeners know?
No, I don't really think I have anything to add. After an hour and 17 minutes.
I think this is the longest one we've done, actually.
Well, I told you I can't stop talking.
Cool. Awesome. Well, Keelan, thank you so much for your time today. This has been amazing and extremely informative. And yeah.
All right. It's my pleasure.
Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed recording it. Now, whether you're an attorney looking for the next step in their career or a law firm looking to hire the top 15% in your niche, visit us at bcresourcegroup.com to see how we can help.
Thanks for listening to the Path to Partner podcast. For more exclusive content, log on to bcresourcegroup.com or subscribe to the show on iTunes.